the United States has to come to grips with the fact that we're in the early stages of a third world war.
This isn't really Islam as such. It's radicalized Islam, and this war has no clear front lines.
Iran in a few years' time could have nuclear bombs, and I don't have to tell you what the world would look like if Hezbollah had nuclear weapons.
I think that there are moments in history when you need to take people at their word, particularly fanatics.
For decades, the nations of the world have worried about it and wondered about it. But in July of 2006, for the first time in a long time, some serious people began to wonder if it was a real possibility. Were we on the brink of World War III, and how did this happen? Hello, I'm Bob Schieffer. That was the question that many began to ask when almost without warning, two bitter enemies suddenly faced off in one of the most volatile regions of the world. In truth, the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah had been simmering for a long time. All it took was one small spark to ignite a deadly and explosive war. That spark was the kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers, and it set off a chain of events in which the stakes were higher and the outcome potentially more catastrophic than at any other time in history. It all began during a time of relative calm in a tranquil and beautiful corner of the world where most but not all the people wanted peace, Lebanon.
The summer in Lebanon is a very festive season. You have almost a million people who visit Beirut for the sun, for the sea, for the mountains. It's a magnificent, sophisticated city.
Beirut is called the Paris of the Middle East. But in the summer of 2006, in Beirut and all of Lebanon, there is tension. Hezbollah, radical Islamic fighters operating in Lebanon, crossed the border into Israel, killing eight soldiers, capturing two.
I went to a neighborhood in Beirut. People were celebrating the capture of the two Israeli soldiers. It felt like a winning soccer team. Nobody expected war.
Hezbollah claims its motive for the kidnappings is a prisoner exchange with the Israelis.
The Hezbollah leader, Nasrallah, said, "We captured the soldiers because we would like to exchange them for the three Lebanese soldiers in Israeli jails."
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has no intention of negotiating with Hezbollah, no intention of releasing one of Israel's most notorious prisoners, Palestinian terrorist Samir Kuntar. In 1979, Kuntar and three others murder an Israeli father and his four-year-old daughter just miles from the Lebanese border. The mother, witnessing this from a hiding place, accidentally smothers their crying baby. Kuntar later says he was protesting the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty at Camp David. In the summer of 2006, the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah escalates rapidly. Hezbollah pounds Israel's third-largest city, Haifa, with Katyusha rockets. Israel drops leaflets in Hezbollah strongholds, warning civilians of impending bombing raids. But despite the warnings, there are heavy civilian casualties. There are allegations that Israel's response is too extreme,
where the number of Lebanese civilians who had been killed began to dwarf the number of Israelis hit by rockets. I think the world increasingly said this is disproportionate, and you're punishing not only Hezbollah, which we understand, but the Lebanese population, which we don't understand.
But the Israelis claim that Hezbollah hides its military assets in homes, hospitals, and mosques, making it difficult for them to strike without hitting civilians. Events get out of control so quickly, some compare the kidnappings of the Israeli soldiers to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, the spark that lit the flames of World War I. One of them is former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. As a student of modern European history, he believes this crisis could be the beginning of World War III.
But I think the United States has to come to grips with the fact that we're in the early stages of a third world war. that it's a genuine world war, both because of scale, and second, it's a world war because of the threat of nuclear and biological weapons. If the North Koreans, as people expect, have 10 to 15 nuclear weapons, and if their ally is Iran, that means the Iranians on any given day are one airplane flight away from becoming a nuclear power.
The threat is not Islam, a religion that advocates peace. The threat comes from radical ideology.
But there is no question that the forces of militant Islam, what some people call Islamo-fascism, feel like they are on the move. They are attacking in a variety of places across the globe. They want to impose their own vision of life, not just on their home countries, but on as many other places as they can. And in that sense, they have declared World War III.
We had the First World War, we had the Second World War, we had the struggle against the Nazi and fascist powers, and we had the struggle against the communists. And then here is this great struggle. They're about this discontent that modern Islam brings to the world, and this growth of a kind of political religion. This isn't really Islam as such. It's radicalized Islam, and this war has no clear front lines.
Mr. Speaker, just put this whole thing in context for us. I mean, give us the big picture of what's happening right now.
Well, I think we're at one of the historic turning points in world history. You have to start with nuclear and biological weapons, and the fact that if the terrorist movements and the terrorist dictatorships get these kind of weapons, they will overnight be able to do the kind of damage that we historically thought of as a world war.
In the summer of 2006, it is Hezbollah, a proxy of Iran, on the front line fighting the Israelis. Hezbollah operates a state within a state in southern Lebanon, taking advantage of a fragile government long plagued by occupation and war.
In the 70s and 80s, we felt that Lebanon became a battleground for other parties, regional or international. We are unfortunately used to that, but we don't like it.
Hezbollah has the power and weaponry to launch a powerful attack. Weapons, many assume, are provided by Iran. The timing during the G8 summit may also be Iran's decision.
Iran was under the gaze of the world. Iran's nuclear ambitions were being contested and being supervised. And the Iranians wanted a way that this attention of the world would be diverted away from them.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad proudly admits that Iran is close to getting nuclear technology. He's also not one to hide his disdain for the West.
Very clearly, I will tell you that I fully oppose the behavior of the British and the Americans.
Then in a few years' time, they could have nuclear bombs, and they will have the capability to supply rogue regimes and terror organizations with that capability. And I don't have to go very far in order to tell you what the world would look like and what the Middle East would look like if groups like the Hamas and the Hezbollah had nuclear weapons.
When Ahmadinejad, the dictator of Iran, says in public before thousands of people on television, I want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth and I want to defeat the Americans, I think we should assume that they are psychologically at war with us. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in 1941, when the U.S. sank a German submarine, when we were at peace, did a nationwide radio address and said, if you're standing next to a rattlesnake, you do not have to wait until it bites you to decide it's dangerous.
Israel doesn't wait for Nasrallah to start an all-out war against it in the summer of 2006. For the Israelis, it is reminiscent of 1967 when Egyptian President Abdel Nasser threatens to drive Israel into the sea. Nasser provokes Israel by closing the Strait of Tiran, a vital shipping route for Israel. He encourages Jordan and Syria to join Egypt in mobilizing for a joint war against the Israelis. Like Nasrallah, Nasser's hope is to reestablish Arab unity and pride.
When we were looking at this crisis early on, one was reminded again of the Egyptian leader. In 1967, he did not want really war. He wanted the gains of war. He thought he would trigger a crisis with Israel, but he would emerge intact. So he closed the Gulf of Aqaba to Israeli shipping, clearly an act of war. He asked the UN forces to leave, and he has war on his hands. It ended in the destruction of his legend and in the destruction of his army.
When Nasser threatens Israel, it is the height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. In 1967, the U.S. sides with Israel and the Soviets supply Egypt. Like 2006, there is fear of a regional battle exploding into a world war. But there is one key difference between the conflict decades earlier and the one today: the role of radical Islam.
We saw it as Americans on 9/11. We saw Madrid, we saw the riots in France, we saw the London bombings. It's people who sharpen the faith for their own purposes, and it's very powerful.
On July 12, 2006, Israel begins its military campaign to root out Hezbollah from southern Lebanon. But as the Israeli Defense Forces soon learn, it is a war against a formidable opponent.
I think the biggest surprise was the resilience of Hezbollah, its ability to withstand the Israeli onslaught, how entrenched it was, how powerful it was.
The 2006 war with Hezbollah isn't the first time that Israeli forces go into southern Lebanon to fight a terrorist opponent.
I'm afraid that we're watching to some extent a repeat of the 1982 experience of the Peace for Galilee operation.
That operation calls for Israel to go 25 miles into Lebanon to wipe out strongholds of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization.
It had felt that there were too many cross-the-border attacks, there were too many rockets had been fired into Israel.
When the dust finally settles after the Israeli invasion in 1982, thousands of Lebanese civilians are dead. As the Israeli army occupies a 9-mile-wide border strip in southern Lebanon, the area becomes a breeding ground for terrorists.
The Hezbollah was born out of the turmoil, the upheaval, the bloodshed. Israel occupied southern Lebanon, the home of the Shiite community, marginalized, alienated, disadvantaged. Hezbollah was born out of this turmoil.
The United States soon finds itself a target of this terrorism. In April of 1983, the U.S. Embassy in Beirut is attacked by a suicide bomber in a truck, killing 63 people. 6 months later, in October, 241 Americans are killed when a suicide bomber crashes a pickup truck loaded with explosives into the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut.
Those who killed the Marines in 1983 were, in fact, members of Hezbollah.
President Reagan had sent in the Marines in an effort to stabilize the chaos in Beirut. In a move that foreshadows the perils of a peacekeeping force in that region, President Reagan withdraws the troops within months of the tragedy. One man the U.S. holds responsible for these bombings is Emad Mugniya. For years, Mugniya has been on the FBI's most wanted list with a $5 million bounty on his head. Believed to be one of the most skilled and dangerous terrorists operating against the West, he is the alleged head of security for Hezbollah.
And they've sent him on various missions around the world to places like Sudan, when Osama bin Laden was living there. Iran sent Emad Mugniya down there to teach Osama's people the elements of running terrorist operations and guerrilla warfare and things like that.
But if Mugniya manages to stay out of sight, the leader of Hezbollah, Sheikh Abus Musawi, is definitely in Israel's crosshairs. In 1992, Israeli forces kill him in a targeted assassination. To succeed him, Hezbollah chooses 32-year-old Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah.
Bob Bayer, who worked with the CIA in Lebanon, says that Nasrallah has been closely linked to Iran for years.
He was recruited in 1982 by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, has consistently told the Iranians that he would follow their orders, and he has followed their orders. He was one of the key leaders in taking the hostages in the 80s, American hostages among others.
I am David Jacobson, one of the three American hostages in Lebanon.
17 Americans are kidnapped off the streets of Beirut during a six-year period beginning in 1982. Former Associated Press correspondent Terry Anderson is held the longest, almost 7 years, before he is finally released in 1991.
I think you know how I feel. Excuse me.
The kidnappings clearly were related to the whole Lebanese mess and to our perceived support for the Israelis. No question about that.
Over two decades later, the man who played a key role in those kidnappings has become the very public face of Hezbollah.
Hassan Nasrallah is a charismatic figure. He is a very strong orator. His mastery of the Arabic language is quite impressive. It is, in fact, stupendous.
With the $100 million that Iran annually gives to Hezbollah, Nasrallah transforms his terrorist organization into a force that includes some 3,000 full-time fighters.
Well, when they started out, of course, they were a kind of a street gang militia, kind of like the brown shirts in Germany or something like that, with Islamic motivations. But now they've evolved to the point at which they are actually, in my opinion, light infantry.
Light infantry that's not afraid to take casualties.
They've got belief. They are willing to become martyrs. They're willing to die. They're willing to hold a position until they're dead.
And Hezbollah is more than just an army.
Hezbollah is a social movement. It provides social services, clinics, daycare centers, schooling, employment. And equally important, Hezbollah provides the Shia community, which is one of the poorest communities, with a sense of identity, a source of pride.
Hezbollah also runs its own television station, Al Manar, and as a political party, it is represented in the Lebanese government.
It's a paradox. Hezbollah is both part of the state, with two cabinet ministers and 14 members of parliament. At the same time, it's apart from the state, and it's its own state within southern Lebanon.
In its fight against Israel, Hezbollah is loosely connected to Hamas, the Palestinian terrorist organization, whose kidnapping of an Israeli soldier in Gaza on June 25th opens the first front in the 2006 Mideast conflict. The tie began in the early 90s when Hamas activists expelled from Israel reportedly ended up in Hezbollah training camps.
Hamas has been getting training from Hezbollah, has been getting support from Hezbollah.
That includes instruction in suicide bombing, a weapon Hamas has used against Israel since the mid-1990s.
And now, my militant brothers.
In this videotape captured by the Israeli army, a Hamas explosives expert teaches the deadly art of bomb making.
The shrapnel must be of equal dimension.
In southern Lebanon, Hezbollah also used bombs, roadside bombs, against the Israeli troops stationed there. In 2000, after years of attacks, Israel decides to unilaterally withdraw its troops.
They were losing men in a small but steady trickle of casualties. It was causing them trouble with grandmothers and people like that in Israel. So they decided to leave.
It was almost as if it was Vietnam and they were throwing the helicopters overboard and scrambling to the top of the embassy and running away.
And it is the unilateral withdrawal from southern Lebanon that gave to Hussein Nasrallah the sense of accomplishment, that sense that he had single-handedly been responsible for liberating Arab land from Israeli control.
After Israel leaves Lebanon, arms shipments to Hezbollah increase, flowing from Iran through Syria.
It was very evident that the Iranians were supplying lots of material to Hezbollah.
Nasrallah, since 2000, has built up this weapons cache in the south. And obviously what they were doing in all these years is preparing for this confrontation.
In August of 2006, the rest of the world watched as the violence in Lebanon and Israel spun out of control. With so much at stake in such a volatile region, there were fears that we might be on the brink of another world war. While Israel and Hezbollah hammered each other with artillery, the casualties mounted, and so did the rage and the sense of despair. And almost from the start, other countries that had a long and complicated history in the region were being pulled into the theater of war.
The United States, Iran, and Syria also have much to gain or lose as the drama plays out. Each nation has a history with the combatants. President George W. Bush maintains close ties to Israel.
The relationship between the President of the United States and the State of Israel is probably closer than it has ever been before Israel's history.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The close relationship between the U.S. and Israel is only a little more than 30 years old. When the new nation of Israel fights for its life in 1948 against the combined forces of Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, President Truman enforces an embargo on the sale of arms to the Middle East, denying weapons to Israel. In 1956, after Egypt nationalizes the Suez Canal, closing it to Israeli shipping, Israel, with France and Britain, captures the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip. President Eisenhower demands that all three nations withdraw. Israel refuses.
Failure to withdraw would be harmful to the long-term good of Israel. It would jeopardize the prospects of the peaceful solution of the problems of the Mideast.
Under pressure, Israel agrees to withdraw, but relations between its government and President Eisenhower sink to a new low. The late Israeli statesman Abba Ibn remembers.
He didn't seem even to know how to spell our name, and that did not increase our tranquility in any kind of, in any sense of the word. He wrote Israel, I-S-R-E-A-L, but there did arise a succession of American presidents who knew how to spell our name.
Beginning with President John F. Kennedy, relations between the two countries grow closer. And in 1968, President Johnson warmly welcomes Israeli Prime Minister Levi Eshkol to the U.S.
Shalom.
He also supplies American Phantom jet fighters, the first time the U.S. ships offensive weapons to Israel. His successor, President Nixon, and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, dramatically order military aid airlifted to Israel during Israel's 1973 war with its Arab neighbors. By the time the war ends in a ceasefire, the U.S. has made a significant commitment that remains to this day.
The relationship was such that no matter what might happen, if Israel's security was threatened, there was no question the United States had to act.
And it gave us the impression that we had an alliance, something very close to an alliance with the United States.
Beginning with the Nixon years, the American presidents and secretaries of state have worked for a lasting peace between Israel and its Palestinian and Arab neighbors. But while its link with Israel is strong, the U.S. also forms close, cooperative relationships with many of the Arab countries.
The United States created an axis of friendly Arab countries, all of whom are dictatorships, on which we rely to manage the region. And the most important conflict in the region, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict. So Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt all work to, whenever there was a problem, on bringing the Palestinians to the table.
However, despite years of effort, there is no resolution or lasting peace. Critics say President George W. Bush has not done enough diplomatically.
Well, there's no question that this administration has had a different approach to diplomacy. You can argue that the administration should have been more engaged, but you do need to ask the question, is talk always the best thing?
And so you can't engage in one country negotiations. You got to be thinking about the entire game we're caught up in and how do we win across the entire range.
Others believe the lack of a peace process to resolve the Israel-Palestinian problems is a mistake.
We don't have a process that we can turn to. People can fall back on a process, whether you're Arab or whether you're a Jew or whether you're the United States or the international community. And it gives you the chance to manage tragedy. And we don't have that now.
In the early weeks of the Lebanese conflict, while other nations call for an immediate ceasefire, critics charge President Bush plays for time.
Clearly, we're agreeing with Israel that there is potentially a military solution, or to put it more cavalierly, give war a chance.
The calculation of the U.S. administration was that the Israeli attack on Lebanon would be effective, and that it would be short, it would be decisive, and it would destroy Hezbollah. And I think that was, on the part of the U.S. administration, was a miscalculation, because it has cost the U.S. in terms of its regional credibility, and it will make it more difficult to manage the Arab Street.
The so-called Arab Street, a term used to describe popular opinion in the Arab countries, believes the U.S. is behind Israel's battering of Lebanon. It sees the U.S. as Israel's paymaster, protector, and provider of arms.
If you talk to Arabs throughout the region, they see this small country called Israel, which has superior firepower. It has an American umbrella protecting it militarily, diplomatically, politically. And the argument that Israel's existence is on the line does not actually make a lot of sense to many people in the region.
The Bush administration originally had high hopes for the rise of a stable democratic state in Lebanon.
It's been my honor to welcome the Prime Minister of Lebanon to the Oval Office.
Now, friendly relations with Prime Minister Siniora are frayed by the war, and many fear Lebanon might once more drift into civil strife, its democratic government one more victim of the bombs.
And Lebanon was probably poster child number one for Bush doctrine on democracy promotion. So I think that's the real tragedy.
The policies we are pursuing will likely contribute to the collapse of that government. And if it does collapse, it will be replaced by a government that is more pro-Hezbollah and more pro-Syrian. It's kind of a vicious circle working the wrong way.
The U.S. faces the prospect that Hezbollah's sharp rise in credibility on the Arab street could undermine its long-term allies, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia.
Do you think this conflict in the end will bring Arabs together, the Sunnis and the Shiite, or will it shatter Arab unity?
It will do the latter, I'm afraid. And we already see evidence of this shattering of this Arab unity, and we see the kind of the sharpening of this very atavistic and very primitive Sunni-Shia war. We see it in Iraq, we see it elsewhere in the region. I think there's tremendous turmoil in the Arab world.
Meanwhile, the two major background players in Hezbollah's camp, Iran and Syria, are assessing their gains in a war by proxy that could change the shape of the entire region and perhaps the world in the years to come. The winds of war in Lebanon could yet sweep the world with increasing conflict, for behind Hezbollah's rockets are convulsive changes in the Middle East that have brought power to forces far from the killing fields in Lebanon. This power shift has been most noticeable in the fall of Iraq and the rise of Iran as a force to be reckoned with in the region. It is also the product of history within Islam and with the West. Whatever the outcome of the proxy war on Lebanese soil, this struggle for dominance will continue to play itself out. One important factor is a movement some call the Shia Revival.
We are witnessing an awakening by the Shiite community.
Half the Muslim population of the Mideast are Shiites, but until recently they have been among its poorest citizens without much power.
The events in Iraq, for the first time in an Arab country, shifted power from Sunnis to Shiites. And this political momentum towards assuming more power and rights is the dynamic force within the region, which is gradually shaping its politics.
The ascendant player in the Shia revival is Iran. Once the ancient empire of Persia, Iran is not an Arab country and in the past has often been at odds with its Arab neighbors. One reason is because most of its population are Shia, a branch of Islam often despised and persecuted by the Sunnis, who are the majority in most Arab states.
The differences are not so much anymore just theology and religion, but there is baggage of history. There are memories of conflicts that have happened before.
That animosity has existed for centuries, but it has been fed by 10 years of fighting between Iraq and Iran in the last century.
In the 1980s, Iran and Iraq fight a long war that includes chemical warfare and costs both sides horrendous casualties.
Probably took the lives of a million people, and several hundred thousand more Iranians were maimed and became invalid as a consequence of the war.
The majority of Iraqis are Shia, but have been suppressed by Saddam's Sunni-dominated Ba'athist Party for years. When the U.S. overthrows Saddam in 2003, it changes the balance of power in Iraq and in the region.
It was not so much the liberation of individuals that the U.S. achieved as it was the liberation of the Shia community that it achieved.
And the invasion has given the Iranians a longer hand in Iraq politically, doctrinally also.
Iran has had a long and torturous history with the United States since 1953, when the American CIA supports a military coup overthrowing the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, who is considered pro-communist. The move secures Reza Pahlavi, the young Shah of Iran, on his peacock throne. He is an autocratic ruler. Many Iranians never forgive the United States. In 1979, the Shah's rule is ended by an opposition movement led by the Shiite fundamentalist Ayatollah Khomeini.
I don't think there's any doubt that what happened in 1979 was a direct result of what happened in 1953. There was a breathing space of 25 years, but what happened was that democratic institutions really didn't develop within Iran.
Ayatollah Khomeini proclaims Iran an Islamic Republic, the first to be dominated by Shia Muslims. His followers storm the American embassy and hold Americans hostage there for 444 days. There is a complete break in relations between the two countries. Khomeini calls for revolution throughout the Muslim world. In the years that follow, Iran is believed to be a major sponsor of Islamic terrorism.
It's the endurance of Khomeini's revolution that is the fact. It's just gone on and on and on. These radicals have always held an important position in Tehran. They are a power that you cannot get rid of easily.
Iran partners with Syria to transmit arms to Hezbollah and Hamas. Over the years, Syria's capital, Damascus, was often visited by American secretaries of state in time of Mideast crisis for consultations with Syrian leaders. No longer.
The government of Syria must stop exporting violence and start importing democracy.
This administration is really not used to talk to other parties. It only dictates. It only tells us, you have to do this, you have to do that. And this is leading both sides to nowhere.
The U.S. withdrew its ambassador from Syria, has threatened regime change in Syria, and doesn't want to deal with Syria.
Syria's President Bashar al-Assad finds new common ground with Iran.
Syria began to identify more closely with Iran and to rely more on Iran So in some ways is a de facto member of that Shia partnership.
Syria, however, doesn't have the financial clout to call the shots. That is the Iranians' privilege, and many believe that the Iranians direct Hezbollah to trigger an incident with Israel.
It's not impossible that they took that step to further the interests of the Iranians, who are obviously very keen to strengthen their role regionally. There's a sizable or even a majority of Lebanese who are Shia.
Others see Israel's massive response to Hezbollah as a long-planned preemptive strike to take out the Hezbollah rockets before America attacks Iran.
Israel wanted to make sure that Hezbollah was disarmed so that after an attack on Iran's WMD facilities, they would not be able to retaliate. Israel is able to take care of this threat now rather than in the context of a much larger military crisis that might erupt after attacks on Iran's WMD facilities.
I think the scale of Israeli bombing of Lebanon had Iran in mind. This was a way to tell the Iranians that if such a thing happens, this is the kind of destruction it could bring.
The most nagging factor in America's dealings with Iran is Iran's nuclear program.
But if Mr. Bush thinks that he can stop our progress, I have to say that he will be unable to do that.
President Ahmadinejad has stated that Iran wants nuclear power only for energy, but many do not believe him.
I think anyone who thinks that Iran is developing nuclear weapons simply as a threat and not to use them is being very naive.
Iran's president has also made provocative comments about Israel.
President Ahmadinejad in Iran has in fact gone out of his way to talk about how Israel should not exist as a state, and how, in his opinion, the Holocaust never occurred. He's used some of the most inflammatory anti-Semitic rhetoric that any major political leader has in the world in decades.
I think that there are moments in history when you need to take people at their word, particularly fanatics.
The United States and Iran have very different visions of the future of Southwest Asia and the future role of Iran in Southwest Asia. And when two countries disagree so deeply, more often than not, the result is a war.
As the rocket fire between Hezbollah and Israel finally subsides in the summer of 2006, the larger questions emerge. Who are the winners and losers in this latest Middle East war? Hezbollah's charismatic leader Hassan Nasrallah goes on television claiming victory against the Israelis, saying he and his Islamic followers are stronger than ever.
You're looking at people that have been humiliated. You're looking at their leadership, which has failed them over and over and over again in wars with Israel. They've lost every single one of them. And here's one guy that stands up to the bully. It's the way they look at it.
Many agree that Hezbollah emerges as a stronger party, both politically and militarily, because it succeeds in provoking the Israelis into the war.
What Hezbollah has done, it has provided a model. A model for the Palestinians and for Arabs and Muslims by saying, listen, this is a paper tiger. Israel can kill civilians, but if you are united, if you are organized, if you are believers, if you believe in your cause, you can not only defy Israel and the United States, you can in fact resist and achieve your cause.
Iran also perceives itself as a clear winner in this war.
Iran has come out of this far stronger than the Iran that you were dealing with before. For instance, Iran is a lot less afraid of military action because the current war has shown that you cannot dislodge Hezbollah easily out of Lebanon. If you cannot crush it after a month of massive bombing, that doesn't advertise very well for a surgical, clean-cut military action against Iran.
Iran's proclaimed victory comes at a time when U.S. credibility in the region is at an all-time low.
It's ironic that American power is the greatest it's ever been, and America's standing in the world is the lowest it's ever been.
The Lebanese politicians are more afraid of Syria and Iran than they are of the U.S. The Syrians are more afraid of Iran than they are of the U.S. It's very hard to drive a wedge when people think that the other guy has a bigger gun than you do and the other guy will use it.
The consequences for the United States and the Middle East appear ominous.
There's no question that the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and others in the region see Iran as a threat. They are not all Shiite, and they don't want to see Iran emboldened to do more terrorism that could affect their areas. There is no doubt in my mind that Iran would like to use nuclear weapons. If it has the weapons, it will use them. It will start with Israel. It may even move into Europe, and it would just love to give those weapons to a terrorist group to infiltrate the United States.
Those who believe in this scenario raise the possibility of a preemptive strike against Iran.
I think the judgment of the Bush administration is that atomic ayatollahs are unacceptable, that diplomacy is probably not going to stop their program, and that their only recourse is military action. So I think the Bush administration is probably going to strike Iran's WMD facilities probably in 2007. I think they understand that if the Americans don't do it, the Israelis will.
So the question is, how would a scenario play out if the United States engaged in all-out war with Iran?
If it got that bad, who would be aligned with who here? Who fights who?
Well, I think in the end, North Korea and Iran and Syria and Hezbollah and Hamas and al-Qaeda and maybe to some extent Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and the Castro brothers in Cuba.
Seasoned peace negotiators like George Mitchell caution that there are steps the United States can take to avoid all-out war, like engaging in dialogue with our friends and our enemies.
It's hard to stop a war when you won't talk to the people who are fighting the war. That's not rocket science. That's pretty much common sense.
Naturally, Syria is more than willing to engage with the United States the moment the United States realizes that it is important to engage Syria. But we are talking about serious engagement, the sort of engagement we used to have when Secretary Baker would come to Damascus, or Secretary Warren Christopher, or Secretary Madeleine Albright, when they would sit with us and we would look together for solutions.
I very strongly advise the European capitals and the European countries to look very closely at what is happening in Beirut. If they're not careful, and if this is not settled, the horror which we've been seeing in Lebanon will be playing, as you say, in theaters everywhere. Because what we're seeing today are the seeds of the extreme fundamentalist Islam is trying to take over not just parts of the Middle East, but maybe even parts of Europe, and they better be damn careful about that.
I think what the Iranians are looking at is a long-term final conflict with the West, to throw it out of the Middle East. I think that's the way the radicals in Tehran are looking at it. Their time has come. Listen, they don't sit around and watch American Idol in Tehran.
The question is, are we prepared to respond with a campaign plan that leads to victory? We unraveled the entire Soviet Union without firing a shot. I don't think it has to be a military war, but it's like 1935 with Churchill and Hitler. If we don't recognize how dangerous these countries are, there will come a morning in the next decade that we will lose a city to a nuclear weapon.
The fact is that you can bring violence to an end by creating incentives for both sides to do so. And I think that's possible in the Middle East. I really sincerely believe it can be done because it is in the interest of all of the parties to end this conflict.
Clearly, the story of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah is not over, nor are the concerns that this brief but intense war was just the beginning, that a larger, longer, and far bloodier war is still a real possibility. As the dust settles and the smoke clears, all sides are claiming victory. But observers cannot help but wonder who, if anyone, really won.
This time, the conflict did not rise to the level of a world war, but we are left to wonder, will that be the case next time? Thank you for joining us. I'm Bob Schieffer.